Hello and welcome to another Ship.Energy podcast. This is Mark Williams, broadcasting to you from Cambridge here in the UK. My guest this week is Simon Hindley, Managing Director of Solis Marine Engineering. Simon's a naval architect with experience in offshore, shipping, defence and renewable energy industries. He's worked on ship and submarine design and operation, things like stability analyses, structural analysis, hydrodynamics and standardisation. Simon's responsible for numerous engineering projects ranging from research and development to demonstration projects covering clean shipping and marine renewable energy. In this podcast, Simon and I are going to talk about some of the different projects he's worked on, including alternative fuels, including ammonia, methanol, fuel cells and batteries. Simon, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on.
Cool, thanks for having me.
Well, it's a delight to get you on. We should let everyone know, we tried to record this podcast a few months ago, but we had technical issues and, broadband isn't always perfect. So here we are again, take two.
Fingers crossed, that's one of the joys, I guess, of living in Cornwall. So it's a nice place, but they don't always have the best connectivity.
So it's a good time to get you on, actually, because you have recently won an award. So it's sort of nice to be able to sort of shine a light on you and why you got that. But before we get to that, perhaps for those who don't know you or Solis amongst our listeners, please could you introduce yourself and the organisation?
Of course. So I'm Simon Hindley. I'm the Managing Director at Solis Marine Engineering. I'm a naval architect, worked in all sorts of sectors over the years, from defence through to offshore marine renewables and clean shipping. We've been operating for 5 years. We've now got a fantastic team here in the UK and also in Singapore. And sort of two key areas are marine renewable energy and clean shipping, kind of trying to do our bit towards the net zero 2050 ambitions. So I think if we're going to spend a lot of time at work, might as well target it for something that should be of benefit to us all. That's our kind of driving force, as it were. And enjoying what we do.
That's great. Well, that's what this podcast is all about, so it's good to have you on. So we don't get enough naval architects on here, you know. We need to sort of learn more about the latest designs and what's happening, so it's good to have you. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of that, tell us about the award, please.
So we're super stoked to receive the Maritime Innovation Award from National Maritime up in London International Shipping Week a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, huge thank you to the team. They're the guys that did all the hard work to get us there. And a big thank you to National Maritime and Arxen, who are the sponsors for the award as well. The award, I think, is very timely. We've been doing a lot of work recently with the clean shipping projects. So projects spanning an 80-metre supply boat out in Singapore, being converted to run on ammonia, so it'll be a zero-carbon vessel. Working on hydrogen fuel cell designs and now a conversion that's going to be starting very shortly. Flexible fuel option designs, where you're trying to de-risk all those tricky future fuel design choices at this early stage on a vessel, so maintaining flexibility through the life of the vessel, which I think is very important at the moment. A lot of work understanding duty cycles, methanol fuel, electric ferries, and how we charge them and the infrastructure that goes with it as well. So it's a good time to be innovating in the sector, and really nice to be recognised for it.
So was the award for a particular project or just for your all-round amazing brilliance?
That's it. I think, it's an all-round award, as it were. So just us persevering, trying to drive it forwards as best we can. General rather than a specific project.
Very good. Well, congratulations. Very pleased for you, because I know that you do a lot of work across the different alternatives to hydrocarbon propulsion and vessel design as well. Let's home in on some of the particular projects. Let's start with this electric and battery operated vessels. You've been working on electric ferries, I believe.
Yeah, that's it. So a few designs over the years. So one was a recent one, which was for Plymouth. We worked with another local naval architecture firm called Palantic Design that we work very closely with. And that was for a 150-passenger electric vessel. It had to charge up overnight because the quayside infrastructure was listed, so you couldn't attach any infrastructure for charging during the day there. So that gave us quite a tricky duty cycle. So then we're looking, obviously, the standard stuff from resistance, propulsion, sizing up the motors, the vessel design, battery capacity, but then also looking at manoeuvring as well. The vessel spent quite a lot of time manoeuvring in and out of the berth, where it's got crosswinds, etc., it's got to deal with. So how we dealt with that in terms of a holistic model for the operating profile of the vessel, levels of uncertainty. And that's the general thing with all of these future fuels, is making sure that because it's more expensive, it's less energy dense, you've got to be really accurate on that operating profile, the duty cycle, as we call it, so that the design is efficient as possible, low cost, but still performing the required work for the project, the route. And then, that we had a sort of preliminary design that then was submitted into the UK MCA and Bureau Veritas for review. And that was the end of that project. Yeah, it was a good one. It'd be nice to see it happen, that's for sure. And we've been discussing some other electric vessel projects over the years as well, including subsea charging buoys, things like that, to help to support the vessel on the infrastructure side. That's just as important.
And the next question I was going to ask subject to that was, what are the main challenges to a fully electric power? And it sounds like duty cycle and battery size is one of them. So.
That's it, you've got it in one. So it's, the batteries are expensive. Obviously, they're a risk that needs to be managed in terms of the lithium ion or whatever chemistry is being used. They need to be certified, so we know that they're safe for use. And so it is a big challenge. The sort of upside of that, potentially, down the line, is obviously we move to greater electrification, cost reduction in batteries as production values increase. The nice thing is if you've got renewable energy sources somewhere in the locality, then having that direct electrical conversion from the, say, a wind turbine, for instance, or another method of generating electricity through to the vessel, potentially via some storage, is a nice way to do it because you've got less conversion. So say, for instance, if you're running a smaller harbour vessel on hydrogen or ammonia or another fuel, then obviously each of those conversion processes takes out some of that original source energy. So every step you're reducing the overall system efficiency. So for nearshore vessels such as ferries where they can recharge daily or hourly depending on their route and their profile, it's a nice option for an overall efficient system.
Recently I was driving on the motorway in the UK going around the M25 around London, the orbital car park as they call it, and I watched a car in front of me, an electric car in front of me, catch fire. So I could see white smoke as I was driving down the motorway. I thought, where's that come from? And I thought, well, that's a very electric-y kind of smell in the air. And then a bit further along, I caught up with this thing in the inside lane with sort of purpley-blue flames coming out from underneath it. And the guy pulled over to the hard shoulder. And then the poor guy couldn't get out of his car because he would have had to walk through the flames that were coming up from underneath. So, what are the safety issues around batteries? Because electricity and water generally don't mix very well. So once you put batteries or lithium ion into ships, what are the safety considerations?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's where a huge amount of effort's being performed at the moment in terms of certification of batteries, testing to enable that certification to make sure that they are type approved by IAC or a similar classification society. And then you've got sort of design considerations then as well that then make. So it's looking at how do you contain those batteries in the compartments? Do you have ready access to cooling for that, so if they're getting too hot? And then if you take it back a step from there, so if a battery's gone up, then obviously there's a cause for that. So if you look back into, okay, what's the root cause? What could it be due to? And a battery, as it says, is a battery of lots of big modules. Each of those modules contains cells. And some of the battery management systems and things like that, look at either the battery as a whole or as a module as a whole. So it might still be trying to apply charge. But there may be a faulty cell within that module, and it's knowledge that you've got a faulty cell in there in the first place, so that you don't then try to charge something which could then later become an issue. So the critical thing there, I think, is also on the control and monitoring to minimize the risk in the outset. So, okay, we've got design consideration for if it goes wrong, but I think we also need to spend time looking at what may cause it to go wrong, and doing that in a way that enables good understanding how those cells operate, how you can detect that. There's methods out there for detecting those faulty cells, and then you can isolate that at an early stage. So therefore, don't keep trying to apply charge to it or discharge it, which then can cause an issue. So I think it's that that sort of battery operating profiles, all that sort of stuff is really key. Or part of the challenge, I'd say, and that's the other part of it.
Let's talk about your ammonia-powered offshore vessel, I think you said it was, that you've been working on. So as far as I know, there are no current vessels using ammonia as fuel. There's nothing on the water currently using ammonia as fuel. But you've worked on designing a vessel that can burn ammonia.
Yeah, that's it. So it's a really good project. So this is using ammonia in an internal combustion engine. And then we're doing the sort of the ship interfacing sort of work, so naval architecture, stability, structures, documentation for class, and take through sort of classification society approval work. And there's another company which is doing all the fuel conversion technologies and the details of the ship systems. So we're working closely with those guys. The project as a whole, moving forward nicely, we're hoping to see it in the water later this year. As a demonstrator to show the feasibility, but also the added benefit, I think, of projects like this is it gives an interim step. So where there's existing tonnage, which is, not that old, but it may not have the cleanest emissions from a greenhouse gas perspective, then it's looking at ways of converting that existing tonnage so that it can be operated in a low emission way, but with minimal cost and disruptive vessel refit work. Because with stuff like this, you've either got drop-in fuel options, say, with the biodiesel, biofuels, etc., but then you've still got what's happening at the sea, at the carbon side of that. If it's come from the atmosphere, it's getting back to the atmosphere, or if you need some carbon capture there at the exhaust end. But I think fuel technologies like this, where it's like an engine conversion rather than full replacement of the entire drivetrain or full vessel replacement, scrapping a vessel that's still got plenty of life left in it, is a total waste of resources as well. So I think as an interim measure, the lower hanging fruit on existing vessels and tonnage, I think this is the good way to go about it. With the ammonia, obviously, you've got that greater energy density. So in terms of longer endurance offshore, deeper sea shipping and trade, it's probably one of the sort of more likely candidates, I guess. So the jury's still out on what future fuels are, and and there's probably going to be a range depending on the operating profile of the vessel, supply, and joining all that. But it's definitely a great project, and one we're really, really pleased to be involved with. And we do hope that we should see it operating later in the year, fingers crossed.
Can ammonia just be pumped into a standard internal combustion engine is it liquefied to put into as a fuel into the engine?
Yeah, so with ammonia, it's atmospheric temperature and pressure. It's a gas, so it's maintained under pressure, and then it's difficult to combust, so it needs a pilot fuel, so it still needs some diesel in there in a small percentage. So usually in a diesel engine, you'd have a smaller percentage of fuel and a much larger percentage of ammonia. That diesel fuel helps get the combustion going, and then you're running it through. So several things, you need to, there's some engine conversion work that needs to happen. There's also secondary systems to support the ammonia side of that conversion, enclosures, etc., then make sure the toxic zones and hazardous areas are maintained. It's certainly a decent option.
And have you done anything on fuel cells recently?
Yes. So, yeah, that's been another good one. So this is where we're kind of, I guess we're almost taking the middle bit. So we've looked at the electric ferries, the short sea, sort of in harbour or coastal use. So, you've got endurance, up to a day, perhaps. So, maybe a bit more at push, but you're in the sort of ballpark before the batteries start driving the design of the vessel too much. Then at the other end, we're saying ammonia, that's feasible for deep sea shipping, large vessels, big routes, big endurance, as a replacement for heavy fuel oil potentially down the line. And then sort of in the middle is where we can see some of the fuel cell options working. So say if you've got an endurance of about a week or so, then that could be an operating profile that would work with the fuel cell conversion. That'd be hydrogen fuel cell. So you've got hydrogen stored as a gas, or type 3 or type 4 bottles, which are sort of 350 to 700 bar. So that in itself is it's a risk and needs to be managed. Then looking at ventilation, what to do with the hydrogen, again managing the safety aspects of things there in terms of the piping and ventilation requirements. Running that hydrogen fuel through a fuel cell, you can then obviously generate electricity that way. And this is where I come back into that whole modular sort of vessel layout, where we've got, I think that the bit that will always probably stay the same is, if we've got a propeller driven by an electric motor, take that as given. We've got switchboards feeding that. Then it's how do we feed power into those switchboards? Is it coming from a fuel cell? Is it coming from a genset running methanol or ammonia? Is it coming actually just from battery storage? Or is it a mixture of those things? And that's where the fuel cell conversions tend to go more into a mixture part. So fuel cells, they like to be throttled. So i.e. they want to be running at constant output. So vessels have pretty transient power demands quite often. If you're looking at operational loads, if you've got deck equipment, winches, A-frames, things like that, the propulsive side is a bit more level, but still you're locked in with your speed changes. And so then tied up with a fuel cell is a battery system, and then that can do all of the handling of those transient loads that the fuel cell wouldn't respond nicely to. And so it's got that fuel cell constantly putting power into the battery, and then all your system demands coming that into the vessel. We worked on a desktop study a little while ago under Innovate UK supported Clean Mountain Demonstration Competition in a wider consortium. And that was looking at feasibility for conversion of a survey vessel. Now that's now being taken forward under CMDC3 to do the actual conversion. So we're starting on that at the moment, working through the design of the fuel cell and battery storage systems on board, weight, stability, arrangement, dead weight carrying capacity required for the operational needs of the vessel, and taking it forwards into design, which then we can take into the shipyard for conversion ultimately. And that we would, in a couple of years' time, so in 2025, that's where we want to see the vessel operating.
And what size fuel cell is in that vessel? What's the capacity?
Yes, that one is, we're looking at a couple of units. So there's a few different options on the table at the moment, but fuel cell capacity of around about 200 kilowatts of range, and it's for a survey vessel, and it's about 40 meters, 50 meters. Yeah, to give that mixed duty profile where it can run in a zero emission mode under the hydrogen fuel cells, or if they can't source hydrogen, then they can still run the existing diesel drivetrain as well. So it's risk mitigation side of things, because we've got to join the supply and demand with the sector as it moves forwards. Obviously, as a vessel owner operator, you can't afford to be in a position where they can't secure green hydrogen to operate. So it's hedging the bets. We've got an existing diesel drivetrain, which is fine. So keeping that on board and then running the hydrogen fuel cell system in parallel. So then we can operate on either a zero emission mode or not, depending on the fuel availability. So they don't affect vessel operations and charters ultimately.
We had Maddie McLean the CEO of Zestus, the Zero Emissions Ship Technology Association, on the show earlier this year. Maddie said that you could potentially now use fuel cell technology to power about 40% of the global fleet, you know, the smaller 40%. It seems to me that if you've got something like a 30,000 deadweight bulk carrier, that needs something like a 4 to 4.5 megawatt power engine. That's a lot of fuel cells. Are fuel cells ever going to be able to get up to that scale?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. I mean, there's different types of fuel cells. So the ones we've been looking at are PEM, or proton exchange membranes. So they have a lot of rare earth materials in them, so they're expensive. These ones are pretty expensive, that's at 200 kilowatts. So, you know, if you start to look at megawatts, obviously the costs will go up. Now, there's options with two things in on that, you know, sort of shorter sea shipping, like say, you know, kind of, you know, coasters, container vessels, you know, feeder ships, things like that, where, okay, the power bands are a bit more modest. You then may work into some chances of hydrogen storage, so if you're using just pure gaseous hydrogen, but to increase the energy or the volumetric density of that storage, and that one option is to use liquid hydrogen as one option, but then you've obviously got to keep that close to absolute zero, so pretty cold, you know, -270 odd degrees C, that's obviously another balance of plant. That refrigeration plant needs energy, and it's into the whole vessel for energy matrix. Another option could be ammonia, the storage temperatures and pressures are a lot more manageable, and you can sort the liquid state pretty easily. And there's existing codes out there for that. The challenge there is you typically, to run it through a PEM type fuel cell, you'd need to crack the ammonia. So ammonia being one nitrogen atom and three hydrogen atoms. So it's a really good hydrogen carrier, basically. You need to break those bonds, split the nitrogen off, and then you could then pass that hydrogen at a sufficient purity through the fuel cell. But then that's another piece of equipment on the balance of plant.
Does that not also leave you with oxides of nitrogen as an exhaust?
That's it. And
we have rules about emitting oxides of nitrogen.
That's
now.
It, exactly. And the NOx being, you know, about 300 times worse than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So the last thing we want to do is try to improve things that make things worse. So that's a key consideration. But another option is there's in development at the moment some solid oxide fuel cells, which will accept ammonia straight off the bat. So they're a bigger, heavier unit. However, the internal workings of them, if you so call it, is much more simple. It doesn't require as much in terms of rare earth elements and things like that. So that, I think, is for those sort of, you know, higher, you know, talking megawatt sort of scale fuel cells, I think, you know, that could be a route, the solid oxide fuel cells with ammonia. They run at very high temperatures, so some other considerations need to be brought about for that. But as a solution that's being worked upon, you know, I think it's got legs and it's being worked on at the moment. So it's something we're watching very closely, that's for sure.
There'd have to be a good deal of waste heat recovery, wouldn't there, which you could use to run auxiliary power and use boilers and so on.
That's it, exactly. So it's it might bring back some of the, you know, some of the steam turbine machinery that some people have got tickets for that they may not have used so much recently. But I think it's, you know, it's that overall ship efficiency, like say, if you can use heat recovery, increase the efficiency of the vessels as well, you know, so you reduce the energy required as much as possible. That's another side of it. So that helps to make the solution more cost effective. But it'd definitely be nice to see some of those sort of short sea shipping routes. And there's some work happening at the moment on green corridors, like in terms of looking, okay, how do we break down this challenge into smaller pieces? Say, okay, we've got a route A to B. We've got a vessel, we can start looking at its energy requirements, what solutions might be, what does the fuel supply look like, how does that work with the port and infrastructure, and kind of doing these case studies. And then that enables some knowledge, some sharing to happen in the industry that then should help to accelerate more similar projects and hopefully generate a critical mass to the point where then that actually is one of the roads towards the sort of serial carbon shipping.
It's definitely one of the ways to go, isn't it? But the problem with, or the challenge with this, is that it doesn't matter if you're using electrical power or you're using something like ammonia that you've used electrical power, renewable electricity to create. You need electricity. And that has to be renewable electricity. And you, I think you recently did a study where you looked at the electricity requirements to decarbonize just a portion of the UK's shipping. And you found, did I get this right? You found that there isn't enough electricity.
It was a lot. Yeah, exactly. So it was an interesting one. We've been sort of working down here in the southwest of the UK, keeping a close eye on the Celtic Sea region and its floating offshore wind sort of developments there, which I think we'll be seeing some leasing rounds coming up soon. They've indicated some areas of preferred developments. But it was looking at, because at the time, and still even now, there's, you know, concerns out there for grid connection. How do we get this, you know, all this electricity ashore to homes and businesses and everything else? And so, you know, obviously we're kind of really fortunate to work on the marine renewable sector, but also the low carbon shipping sector. So if you kind of see a crossover at that point, well, it doesn't have to be utility scale grid type electricity. What else can we do with those electrons? What useful work can it be? So it's just about having a look at what sort of vessels were transiting around the southwest of the UK. We used a data set from the UK National Maritime Organization and looked at those AIS data sets, filtered through in terms of vessels, their routes, their sizes, their types, their speeds, and then started looking at what sort of energy requirements have they got. So it's a very broad brush, very high level figures in terms of energy requirements of those vessels. So if they were stopping by in the southwest to bunker, what would it be? How much electricity would we need? And we did some assumptions, so assumed it was ammonia that was required. So to get from raw electricity to ammonia, you've got to go through some electrolysis to generate those hydrogen atoms, and then through the Haber-Bosch process to then go from hydrogen to ammonia. So each of those steps, you've got conversion losses. So we factored all of that into account, looked at the energy demand for the vessels, worked out backwards to say, okay, how big a wind farm is that? And it was about 20 gigawatts, which is actually more than the UK installed capacity of offshore wind. So two observations, I guess, from that. One is that shipping is, you know, is a big energy consumer. So, you know, it takes big solutions to this to get us in the right trajectory. You know, small things aren't really going to make a huge impact. But the second one was actually, perhaps this is another option, you know, because if you look purely into, say, biofuels, you know, that are generated from an agricultural basis on land, well, you know, probably don't have sufficient land when we've got a take into effect, you know, feeding and, you know, the human requirements for food as well. So, it was a good case study. We did some little what-ifs looking at what the cost of that fuel might be based on if it was delivering at the current strike price for the offshore wind contracts for difference, and worked it kind of backwards through to those sort of ammonia bits, and it was certainly more expensive. I mean, again, lots of very high level assumptions on all of this, but we're coming at, you know, sort of three times the equivalent price potentially. You know, there's wiggle room on that depending on what you do with storage and everything else. But it was in that sort of magnitude. And then obviously then the bigger question then later on is, well, if marine fuel or zero carbon marine fuels are more expensive, what does that do to the sort of supply and demand, you know, the global trade balance basically? Where if transportation of goods is more expensive, what does that do to the market? I think longer term, having some intuition or at least an approximation of that will help to sort of frame the requirement in terms of what is the magnitude of what we're solving. You don't want to overdo it either. You want to get hit the nail on the head, as it were. So I think some contribution to that, the broader market, would certainly be interesting at some point. And that's what we'd like to have at some point. But yeah, it's interesting to study. Kept naval architects out of trouble for a few days, so that's always good, and made some good learning. So we've got a set of slides that's actually online, which I think you should be able to access through our LinkedIn pages and things like that, that goes through a talk on that in a bit more detail.
So people should go and look for Solis on LinkedIn and can find their way to that.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, so we gave a talk a year ago at Singapore at a Future Fuels event, and so that was recorded, fortunately, so that's available. So there's, you know, there's a few bits of that which, you know, from a project point of view, where there's been some newer movements, but yeah, it covers this case study in a bit more detail, and some good Q&A afterwards too.
That renewable electricity generation piece is the key, as far as I can tell, to achieving anything like net zero targets. The IEA published its roadmap to 2050 progress report in late September, and said in that report that the world has to triple renewables capacity by 2030 to 11,000 gigawatts if it's to stand a chance of reaching the 1.5 Celsius cap on increase. That's a lot.
That is a huge amount, isn't it? And that really does, you know, it really does put it up front and centre in terms of the commitment that's required, I think. You know, everyone thinks 2050, it's still quite a long way away, isn't it? But when you look at the rate that we need to change to meet the climate change ambitions and goals, you know, even 2030, the huge scale of development that's required, and you know, I mean, that's a challenge to make at the best of times, you know, and I'm ever the optimist, and that's, you know, that's the long shot. So if that's by 2030, and need to then maintain it, accelerate further from there to 2050, it's yeah, it's definitely a good reminder of what the target and the challenge is.
There's a senior, one of the senior UK climate negotiators, a chap called Simon Sharp, published a book recently called Five Times Faster, in which he says that if we are to reach the 2030 ambitions, then instead of cutting emissions by 1.8% a year, which is our current trajectory by 2030, we need to be cutting them by 8% a year, five times faster. And his view is the only way to do this is to hugely increase investment. And he says, because of the economies of scale, the faster you go, the cheaper it gets. So, you know, there's nothing to stop us. We should just be pushing ahead.
That's it. Yeah, I think it's a really good observation there. You know, you look at offshore wind now, and it's such an industrialized sector, generating power at good costs. You know, going back 20 years ago, where the first projects going out, you know, the cost of energy from those wind farms is far higher. But because it's been accelerated at a pace, it's got the investment. That investment enables assets that are purely focus on just delivering that one target. You know, you've got wind turbine installation vessels, a category of vessels to help industrialise out their own specification that goes alongside that. And that's the way to do it. It is the kind of all-in approach. You know, no half measures. And then that enables those savings to be made, which then ultimately actually makes it an easier proposition.
He also makes the point, I think, that the carbon taxes can take you so far, but in the end, subsidies are cheaper because they're more closely or more pointedly directed. And he has a very good anecdote about when we switched from horses to cars, government didn't just tax horse manure and hope for the best.
Exactly. I think that's very prominent. But it gives them control as well over their employment, you know, over the resources, you know, people and materials. You know, if you're targeting subsidies, then you have more control over that. It's okay, which may help in the bigger term. I mean, as an example, you know, you might be looking at a floating wind farm. You know, if you were to have just the cheapest possible solution, well, actually, you might end up with a lot of the steelwork being produced in blast furnaces, which are powered by coal, that are then shipped halfway around the world to be installed, which is kind of at odds with the actual requirement and the aspiration for putting in that offshore wind farm. Whereas if you have a more targeted approach, looking at, you know, the overall, you know, how close is it to the ambition? The ambition being to reduce the carbon emissions. How close is that proposed plan for that wind farm or other generating capacity to that? So it's not at odds with it. And I think that's where, like I say, that's where perhaps some of those subsidies and targeted kind of intervention measures might be better than just a tax.
One more question for you. I know we're sort of running massively into time, but I wanted to ask that there don't seem to be a lot of applications for the other main source of renewable power, which is solar. There don't seem to be a lot of maritime applications. So could we not festoon the superstructure of vessels with solar panels and at least run the auxiliary power off them?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely part of the mix, I think, right? Like all these things, it's looking at what all the options are and what's the optimal way of doing it. So depending on the operating profile, you know, if the vessel's running a route with very little solar energy, then okay, perhaps it's less of an option. But if it's running a route that is auxiliary power, you know, it all goes towards it. It's what's the, you know, its implications are, what to do with salt deposits, what's that do to their efficiencies, what sort of efficiencies are the solar panels at the moment, what's it cost, and ultimately it's that business case, you know, they're asking 5 years, 25 years, you know, is it nicely aligned with the vessel, does it help with any other factors of the vessel as well, does it give you the opportunity for some shore power, so you're not having to run gensets in port, you can run off your solar cells on port, that might help in terms of the port emissions as well, which is going to be for local populace. It's definitely part of the mix. I wouldn't rule anything out. I think you want to take everything with an eyes open approach, but make sure you're aware of the pros and the cons to make sure that whatever the end solution is, that it's well engineered and it fits with the required purpose of the vessel.
Great, thank you. That's very helpful, Simon. We've taken up a lot of your time. I'm sort of conscious that you've got other things you need to be doing. So we should probably draw this to a close. I could speak to you all day. You've got so many fascinating projects going on. If our listeners want to find out more, you've mentioned they can go to your LinkedIn, and presumably there's a Solis website they can go to.
There is, yeah. So just head to www.solismarineengineering.com, all one word, and find us there. Or you can find us through our sister company's website, solis-marine.com, and you'll see the engineering link there. And please reach out. You know, we're always happy to discuss these. I think it's a really interesting time. We've got challenges, but I think it's a joined up way of working to tackle them as a team is the way forward.
And you mentioned you'd spoken at the Singapore Future Fuels event. You were at LASW along with the entire world, it seems. any events coming up for people that they could come and meet you in person?
We've got a few events. I think the next time we're up in London is at the Port of Tyne Innovation Maritime Innovation event, which is being held at the BT Tower in London. So I'll be up there along with some of my colleagues, and that is in November.
So people can look out for that one, and we'll post the dates and the details for that on the website.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Mark.
Very good. Well, Simon, thank you ever so much for your time, and thank you to everybody out there in listener land for sticking with us for this, I think, fascinating edition of the podcast. And we look forward to bringing you another episode in the next 2 weeks. Okay, this is Mark Williams for now, signing off from sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK. Bye.